It's also, to me, it makes a lot of sense that that heart attack was brought on by three bouts of pneumonia. And I think people don't realize how really, really hard it is to live outside and how much people deteriorate when they're living outside and how illness is a much bigger deal when you're outside and people don't recover. And I don't think he ever really had a chance to recover from the pneumonia. And he was tired. And I think on some level he was ready to let it go. He felt like nothing was changing and life was hard. And he was a great lover of music, great lover of street musicians, really was out here with people, encouraging people, trying to help people get a little recognition, trying to help schedule coffee house gigs, and actually had a beautiful voice himself, so hope he's happy where he's gone now.
Sherry, you've been around for about a decade. How long was Ryder on the scene as far as you knew? At least a decade. You've been out here for longer. But.
Yeah, I've known him for at least 2 years that he's been, you know, here in Santa Cruz and spending a lot of time listening to music and being part of the music scene. And I think that he got to town just before that, maybe 2.5 years ago from what he said. Yeah.
You've been around a lot. And keeping your eye on the pulse of the street. We had about 6 deaths, according to the Homeless Services Center, I guess, one recently unidentified in a vehicle a couple of days ago, according to the Sentinel. What's your thoughts on what the city needs to do now to, if it can do anything, to address these issues?
I think the city really needs to needs to come to terms with the fact that people who are living outside, number one, need safe and legal places to sleep. And because we really can't provide indoor housing for people in the near future, that the kinds of housing they have, like vehicles or tents, need to be sanctioned. And they also, the city really needs to, at a fundamental level, recognize the rights of people living on the streets to decency and dignity and honor and respect, and kind of get law enforcement off the backs of the homeless people. In fact, there's a musician downtown who said to me recently, he said, the big stressor really isn't so much living outside. The big stressor is that the cops and people passing by make us feel that we're outlaws just because we're homeless. We feel like we're outlaws, and that's the thing that's so stressful, is to feel every day, all day, that you're treated like an outlaw just because you don't have a place to live. And I think it's really that very level of consciousness that things need to change and recognize that if you don't have a traditional house to live in, there's still a whole level of decency and dignity that belongs to you, and that can't be taken away. And there is a lot of pressure on homeless people from law enforcement here, and I think there's a lot of denial about that, the kinds of ways that people's lives are compromised and hassled, and that it really needs to be recognized. It's a schizophrenic city. We offer a lot of services and a certain amount of compassion and a lot of things that are highly detrimental and pernicious to the lives of homeless people, and it's really time to come to terms with that and change it.
I know you yourself have spoken to the Commissioner for the Prevention of Violence Against Women, filed complaints to the Citizens Police Review Board on incidents that happened on Pacific Avenue. If they didn't happen to, well, I mean, they may have happened even to homeless people, but certainly people who are on the streets. Have you had any satisfaction or gotten any sense that the authorities are listening?
It was an experience to file some, you know, formal complaints with the police department. I've never done that before. In both cases, all of the charges were found to be, you know, unfounded and exonerated by the police chief. In one case, the police review board did uphold one of the complaints, which was that the responding officers endangered the public safety by not pursuing this assailant in a very vicious attack when people knew where he could be found.
So they went out to coffee or lunch or something?
They went out for dinner. And
that's different.
But the police chief didn't seem to find a problem with that. So, I am not surprised that that's basically an ineffective system, but it's sad that it is. I think and I don't really want to, you know, target only Santa Cruz, because I think this is endemic to the American society, that there's a level of control and autonomy that the police, capital P, as an institution, have gotten that really needs to be reexamined, that when you give somebody a gun and the right to take away somebody's freedom and take away their possessions, there needs to be a lot of control of how people behave. And, you know, the police are really essentially, and I'm quoting Scott Kennedy here, a paramilitary force. And
Scott Kennedy, 1990, you know, throughout, or 2001?
Throughout America, we really need to, like, look at this issue. It's a huge issue, especially how it impacts the lives of homeless people, street people, people of color. It's just, again, I feel like we're in denial about what's really going on, and it needs to be faced.
A couple years ago, you, after Catherine Byers and others failed to reform or repeal the sleeping ban in a significant way, you tried to get together a group of folks to consider a campground or a civil disobedience protest, perhaps, around that issue. You think that that is an avenue that could still be taken? Was it one you think you were persuaded was perhaps not feasible at this time? What's your sense on that?
I have often at times myself considered organizing a civil disobedience action. And personally, I feel like to do that, one needs to be very clear about why and how, and being able to commit to perhaps a long haul in terms of time. And so it's not something that I would ever undertake lightly. I think I have hoped that because this is Santa Cruz and we think of ourselves as liberal and compassionate and conscious, that the changes could come at the legislative level, because they could come at the legislative level. They have not. And I am beginning to feel that probably the only way the change is going to come is through civil disobedience and then going through the courts, just like with the civil rights movement in the 60s. I grew up in the 60s and watched that unfold. And I think it may take that, but I think it, you know, that's not something that, for me, I would do lightly. You know, not because I don't think it needs to be done or couldn't be done well, but because I think you have to have a very clear vision and really know what you're doing and how to do it nonviolently, how to do it and say what's wrong and yet really believe that any of the people who are right now on the other side of the equation can have their hearts moved and change. But I more and more feel like somehow it's going to have to come out of the courts or a higher level than the legislative level to say, just like with school desegregation, you know, basically that was ordered. I mean, if we had asked the communities of the South, would you like to desegregate your schools and let them make the decision,
the
schools would never have been desegregated, or the North. And I think it's that way with homeless people. We need to have a sense of what are the basic rights that can't be denied, and then we defend them. And it's not a matter of personal opinion or personal beliefs or personal preference, because often our personal opinions and preferences are based in prejudice and misunderstanding and don't reflect that sense of a higher law that we really need to be accountable to.
You've been listening to Sherry Connable. Thanks, Sherry. Appreciate the, as usual, eloquent assessment of the situation.
The other thing that I struggle with, besides personally, I have felt in these last couple of years, I haven't seen the openings where change could happen, is how to really respect how political action affects the lives of homeless people. What happens in their lives if there's heat on the streets, because they really are the ones who tend to get the fallout from law enforcement, and how to bring them into the process in a way that it's really coming out of their sense of their felt needs and their reality and their empowerment. Because it's such an oppressed community, it's really hard for people to risk anything. And it's really different in that way from the civil rights movement, where once black people were ready to come forward, they were a little less at risk than homeless people are living the lives that they lead. And how to sort of jump that barrier to make sure that homeless people can be involved, that they want to be involved, and that it really truly is expressing what they feel they need and what their reality is on a daily basis. I think it's a key element of doing that kind of activism well.
And always hard to do. Homeless people, as an organizing force or organized force that's just so transient, so vulnerable, and have to spend so much of their time surviving, that often it's sort of an ad hoc kind of situation, which sort of is the antithesis of the well-planned, long-haul sort of perspective you mentioned, the need that is really there to get that done.
And I think it is hard to understand that. piece of it if you haven't lived on the streets or been closely involved with people who are living outside or camping. And you know, I there are substance abuse issues, and those are real. And what I've seen again and again with people who are living outside is the longer they're outside, the longer there's not relief, the substance abuse tends to get worse because it's a natural response. And it's almost like by being forced into that position, their chance to grapple with those issues is even lessened. And I don't think people understand that. They sort of think, oh, you know, they're on the streets because they're alcoholic or they use drugs. Well, it might be a piece of their lives. But in fact, it gets worse when you're living in this place where it's kind of it's hard to get relief. It's hard to get, you know, any sense of comfort.
It's hard to get warm at night.
It's hard to get warm. It's hard to get food sometimes. It's hard to get a shower, to feel clean, to feel even good about yourself, you know? We all know what it's like. You don't have a shower for 3 or 4 days, you don't feel too great.
Or just, and of course, how can you shower off the hostility and the lack of communication,
yeah,
the stereotypes that are leveled at you every moment, or frequently, certainly, on the streets, even in Santa Cruz, which has a progressive reputation, so forth.
I think that's one of the very hardest parts, as this person said. It's this sense of people treating you like you're sort of dirt, and you're an outlaw, and you don't count just by virtue of your station. And there are no crimes of status. I mean, there are none. And it's, I don't know, it's just something that we really deeply, deeply need to change. And this is a very sort of appearance and materialistic culture, appearance-based culture. And, you know, as a woman in the culture, I'm very aware of discrimination based on appearance. And it needs to be stopped.
Is there an economic engine at work here, Sherry, in Santa Cruz that is making it harder for homeless people than it was a decade ago? Or, for example, if you look at the camping citations, they're certainly down from a decade ago, due in large part to activism and people speaking up. But what about the conditions of rent are certainly worse than they were 10 years ago.
They're much worse.
How does economics and what the powers that be in the town and their economic interests play into this?
Well, I think that's pretty complex at this point. I think there's no question that the rent scene is a really defining factor. I mean, there are a lot of people who can't afford rent. There are a lot of people who are working full-time who can't afford rent. And, you know, I think the Silicon Valley really has added to that pressure a lot. You know, that happened in sort of a twist of fate. The Silicon Valley happened right over the hill from us, you know, and has put so much pressure on the economy and the market here. But years ago, when I first got involved in city politics, there was a rent control campaign, and it lost by not a whole lot of votes. And
we're never going to hear the end of that loss. Okay.
I really believe that housing and land should not be, like, even open to speculation. It's like a place where it's just too essential. People deserve to be housed. They deserve to have some access to land. And that we allow this sort of spiraling, crazy, you know, get rich quick off housing and off land is just, it's sad. It's sad. Again, it's like it's endemic to the culture. It's not just Santa Cruz. Unfortunately, we are right over the hill from one of the very richest business, you know, sectors on the planet at this point. You know?
Or at least before the stock market crash, yeah.
So, I don't know.
Well, hey, that was more than I expected to get, Sherry. I appreciate your, you know, speaking on these issues and on this situation with Ryder. And anything else you want to say?
No, not really. I mean, I feel like one of these days I'm going to, like, have one more big push, maybe, to see if it can be changed. And as you've pointed out, Robert, that, you know, may ultimately have to be CD action. I don't know. That may be what it takes. I really hope that it could happen. But every time I see people elected, particularly city council, who come in with a fairly radical position, they're not in office too long before they start to slide to the center and get scared. And, you know, the county has been just really, really irresponsible for years and years. I mean, they don't in any way do their part in this situation, and people seem to let them get away with that. Most counties are taking a lot more responsibility for, you know, providing services for folks. So, yeah, I just don't, right now it doesn't look like it's going to happen, you know, out of the legislative bodies. So
it has to come up out of our bodies.
Yeah, our people's bodies who die and suffer and And a writer told me a few times how, you know, he was sleeping on the pavement some of this winter. He had a little piece of cardboard, and, you know, he's 55 years old, and he had really bad knees, and, you know, as I said, he had pneumonia 3 times, and it was a hard life, you know.
And a quick death, or an unexpected one.
Yeah, people were very surprised, and I really feel for him that if he was going to go, I'm glad that he, you know, went quickly and didn't have to go through some long lingering illness or something. But
went around a circle of people at least who noticed him.
Yeah.
And didn't make him invisible as so often happens.
Ryder was really a fixture on the mall. He was always here, every day. You know, he was talking to people, and so, yeah.
Thank you.
And that was Sherry Connable speaking yesterday on Pacific Avenue, where, well, within 5 or 10 feet of where Ryder, one of the 6 or 7 homeless people who we actually know have died since the beginning of the year, where Ryder used to kind of hold court, pass on the news of the day, ask how you were doing. Don't recall he ever panhandled me, but I got him a coffee every now and then. We talked. He's dead, I believe, at the age of 45 of a heart attack last week. Goodbye, Ryder. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norse. This is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor. My broadside is up against the microphone and waiting to hear from you on what you think about what's going on out there. What is happening out there on the streets? What's happening in your life that you think could be made better by people getting together and doing something about things like rents and the law and injustices that folks suffer here in Santa Cruz, silently usually, or they complain and then they just grin and bear it, pay the fine. There was a forum on Thursday night right after my show also airs 6 to 8 on Thursdays, and I do a sort of a separate show. It's a shorter show, but pretty much the same kind of stuff. A forum organized by an activist who may well be going to jail. He certainly is going to be returning to custody for a period of time. His name is Jim Costner, Just Man Jim, as I call him. Talks like a preacher, acts like a lone wolf often, but does seem to be able to draw together a number of people around a number of issues. And he did that on Thursday night, 2 or 3 days ago, at the Veterans Hall. He actually had a crowd of 50 to 70 people in the basement of the Veterans Hall talking about issues ranging from the genocidal heroes that our culture tends to continue to laud, like Christopher Columbus, whose statue Costner smashed in San Jose last month, and for which he faces 2 felonies, even though the vandalism of the statue doesn't rise to over $50,000, according to his attorney, Larry Hildes, and according to a newspaper account that he presented from 1958 when the statue of Columbus was given to the City Hall at San Jose. It was only at a $3,500 value, and even if you multiply that by a factor of 10, that's still $35,000 under the $50,000 felony limit. But anyway, Jim's been charged with 2 felonies, and in response to that, and in response to his concern with injustices in Santa Cruz and elsewhere, held this forum. A number of speakers spoke. We're going to kind of tune in on him. The forum was interesting to me for a number of reasons. I was coming to it with a certain anxiety and a certain sort of nervous spectator expectation, because the Metro Santa Cruz had announced not only that Jim was throwing this forum with the help of a number of out-of-town speakers, some of them coming from as far away as the Central Valley, like Danny Garcia, whose brother Mark Garcia was killed by San Jose police, but also because he himself is apparently a fugitive from a warrant. And we knew the police can read the Metro. We wondered when and where they were going to show up to pick Jim up. They didn't show up. He did speak. And we're going to hear his speech shortly. But first, we have a caller. Hi, caller. You're on Free Radio.
Hi, is this Robert?
It is.
Hey, Robert, my name's Scott Simmons. I met you about 5 years ago at a Board of Supervisors meeting. I've got a little girl in a wheelchair, and I gave you a tape of a song I'd written about the helicopters.
Okay. I may have never played it or heard it, but I certainly should have.
Might not have. that's not important. But
are you listening to the show, or is this just a sort of...
No, I was listening to
good.
The show.
Yeah, and, some folks are out of the range of the show, and they call in anyway. But go ahead, Scott.
And we're sitting down here on Pacific Avenue in our motorhome, and got a family of three here. It's myself. And
should I call the police to have you arrested? Or?
Oh, please. Anyway. actually, the police in this town have been treated us rather well.
Oh, good.
There's myself and my 9-year-old daughter, who's very, very disabled. You might have seen her around town in her wheelchair with one of the nannies, taking her out, getting her some sun. And then I got my little year-old son, Sativa.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been pretty much living on the streets around here in the parks for the last 4 months. And really, we've been under pressure from, you know, other agencies right now that they were trying to pressure me to institutionalize my daughter. And
your daughter has a disability, or?
Oh, she has terrible disabilities, yeah.
Uh-huh.
She's,
don't institutionalize her if you're willing to take care of her.
Oh, I'm not going to, no.
Right.
No. And actually, the cops and cons, both of us are suckers for kids, and especially kids in wheelchairs, but the cops have treated us really pretty well. We blew up the motor in this thing here about a month ago, and we're parked for 8 days on Front Street behind Kinko's. They let us put a motor in, and we went down here to the downtown host and told them what we were doing. And they said, fine. And then we said, well, you know, we're medical marijuana users, so you're going to smell us baking cookies and, you know, smoking our medicine. And they said, oh, well, there's gang activity in that area. We'll make sure the cops go by every couple hours and make sure he's all right.
All right.
And I'll be damned if they didn't. And, you know,
that
they were very
great.
Careful not to look at us and not to make us nervous. Now, of course, you know, I mean... It's funny to look at that. I got a couple advantages. I got the disabled placard, which means I can park all day. You know, in a metered zone, actually, or a green zone, I can park forever. And, you know, I do have the wheelchair kit. It's hard for people to say no. But we've parked up at Harvey West and other places, and they really haven't hassled us. We've been living recently out of Greyhound Rock. And just the other day, I said, you know, this is great. I mean, I've always wanted oceanfront property, but I'm alone here with the two kids. It makes me a little nervous. Something were to happen to me. And, you know, I thought it's really ridiculous in a society as wealthy as ours that a wheelchair kid like mine, you know, has got to live in a roadside rest.
Sure is.
That's a real commentary. I used to live here in Santa Cruz in 96, and I had a little one-bedroom shack. Cost $700 then. I wish I had it again. And, you know, I'd get so angry when I'd meet wheelchair people that were living under bridges, you know, and I never thought we'd be in this position. But we were told at that time to move to Fresno, so we moved to Chico, and my daughter did very poorly there. She needs to be on the ocean because of her allergies.
It's near the ocean, you say?
Yeah, she can have up to 200 epileptic seizures a day, and allergies trigger them. And I just found that she does really well right here on the ocean. Mm-hmm. Greyhound Rock has been great. We stayed at Harvey West last night, you know, with all the plants up there and everything, and she started having a bunch of seizures like that, 20 or 30 this morning. We came down here to Pacific Avenue, and she's fine. And
wow. That's the first time I've heard of Pacific Avenue being prescribed as a recipe, a remedy. That's great.
Well, Dr. McGarian doesn't think I'm crazy, but, well, yeah, you know, if you can limit environmental factors that make her uncomfortable, that's better than force-feeding her medication. And
Have you actually talked to police officers about this?
About the situation?
Yeah.
Our situation? Not exactly. Not exactly, no.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think, not that I'm saying you should, and I am impressed to hear that, you know, because the police, the hosts are in direct contact with the police. I mean, they use that same
right.
office.
Right.
So
they talk to the police for us. Yeah.
I mean, that to me is... very encouraging, although I would like to ask you some more questions because, you
sure.
know, ever the skeptic, I want to see if I can understand the exact limits or dimensions of this kind of, not just tolerance, but it sounds like a positive attempt to accommodate, you know, in a reasonable fashion, your parking situation and your medical situation and your family situation, too. Did they require written permission of you to be in that parking lot?
Which parking lot was that?
I mean, the one that you, the Kinko's parking lot?
Oh, no,
Oh, that's great.
We just told them what we were doing, said we weren't going to spill any oil. Hey, this is our home. We got to, you know, put a new motor in it. And they said as long as the people at Kinko's didn't care, you know, it was all right with them. They didn't. they didn't mind it, that they would tell the police that it was okay and they should leave us alone.
Are you looking, by the way, for some assistance in terms of a mechanic or in terms of funds for these parts? I mean, would you like
No, it's this was last month. We put a motor in, it runs great.
And now it's simply a question of finding the right environment for your disabled family member.
Yeah, well, actually, for all three of us. And actually, on Tuesday, I'm going to the, I recently had some problems with the, what's called the regional center, which is a state agency that is charged with providing services for my daughter. And really, they've done a very good job over the years. But because my daughter is a medical marijuana person, and because she's 9 years old, even though we've been doing this for 5 years, we were in Magical Blend magazine. I thought if we went in national press, all the assholes could have at us at once. But it's, unfortunately, nobody reads Magical Blend.
Well, we could reprint it in the street shit sheet if you'd like.
Oh, really?
That's our homeless newsletter here.
Really? That would be great.
Yeah. Afterward, if you call 423-HUFF, 423,
yeah.
You know, we can possibly make arrangements to contact you and make you get a copy of the article.
Yeah.
But go ahead. I'm sorry. You were saying you were talking to the regional center and...
Yeah, anyway, we're having a meeting with them on Tuesday, and I'm going to ask them to, since they were trying to push me to institutionalize my daughter, I'm going to try to get them to rent a house for us here in Santa Cruz, although I don't like the idea of the state subsidizing these high rents, but one of their complaints to Child Protective Services that they made recently was that we were homeless.
Really?
You know, in an attempt to put pressure on me.
That's not supposed to be a complaint. That, I mean, that can't. I mean, as I understand it.
Well, neither is medical marijuana, but
right.
You know, people. The right wingers feel empowered right now. You know, they stole the election, and boy, they're empowered.
Well, I don't talk that way about his fraudulency, please.
But and these people have been very good. I get money from the state to hire people as nannies, and in fact. I'm in this big, long, you've probably seen our rig. It's a long white motorhome, has a Bob Marley flag flying from the CB antenna, and a little gray trailer behind it that hauls my daughter's wheelchair, and it's got stoner stickers all over the back.
I'll keep an eye out for it.
We're highly visible, and we're parked at the corner of Cathcart and Pacific, right on Pacific, and the state does give me money to hire nannies to help with my daughter, and I'm always interviewing for nannies. Anybody out there, you want to be a nanny, come by the motorhome, or can I give my phone number?
Sure.
Actually, just come by the motorhome when we're downtown, or it's 278-9020.
278-9020 for those who'd like to
be nannies, yeah.
Yeah, to do a little nanny activity.
It's $12.50 an hour.
That could be worse.
Yeah, it could. It's supposed to be worse, but I don't allow it to be.
You know how it is. I'm scrambling for my pen here, which was here a minute ago, but of course at the crucial moment, there it is. Took a powder. Can you run that number by me one more time?
Yeah, 278-9020.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking again with?
Scott Simmons.
Scott Simmons.
My daughter's name is Joy. She's out on the streets here a lot with her nannies, Amanda or Ava.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you've included us in your circle here, Scott.
Yeah, I've been meaning to get hold of you guys.
How about other folks who you've been parked around? Have you been hearing a similar kind of tolerance from the police, or have you seen a different...
Yeah, I have.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I have. And actually, when I hear of people that have been hassled, you know, I look a little deeper, and, you know, they got a drinking problem, or they're throwing bottles around, or they're making noise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It appears to me it's kind of being selectively enforced against people who are a problem. But
mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm wrong.
No, maybe you're right. You're out there. Yeah.
You know, and some people are problems. I don't know. I mean... way like people, they got to stay somewhere too.
That's right.
So I don't know.
But it doesn't make a difference, and I can appreciate that. In fact, we had asked 2 years ago for the sleeping ban to be enforced only if there is a problem with other laws, and if the police have taken that on as a serious, dictate, then that is a major advance. And of course, the problem is it's hard to tell if it's happening, and then of course it's hard to. Deal with it as a kind of a de facto decriminalization, and because it's so kind of uncertain, and it's also amenable to lawsuit. I mean, someone could sue to enforce the ban. I don't know who would want to do that, but if it's on the books, it's still there to hurt people. But on the other hand, as you point out, it can be used, although other laws can be used to deal with problems, real problems such as disturbing the peace and public intoxication.
Those laws are already there. They don't.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is it makes me nervous, and I'm fairly new here, so I keep looking new on the streets anyway, and I keep asking people, you know, "Is this all right? I'm going to get, I don't want the cops pounding on my door." And stuff. Mm-hmm. We did have, I mean, you talk about really bad treatment. We were over at in Palo Alto at Stanford University, living in the parking lot there. There are other people there living in motorhomes, and getting my daughter, you know, trying to get her state-of-the-art medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And I applied for the in-home supportive services there for my daughter for social services, and they came out, and I told them about the medical marijuana, and we'd been investigated by CPS in six other counties, and they said, we'll have to tell CPS. Well, go ahead. You know, I figured they'd come out, I'll show it, and prescription drugs she's been on, and the side effects, and how they didn't work, and so on. And it'll be civilized. Instead, six Stanford, Santa Clara County Sheriff's deputies showed up in the middle of the night wearing rubber gloves in like full battle gear, nightsticks, mace, you know, guns. Wow. There was one at either end of the motorhome with his holster on, buckled in his hand on his gun, ready to shoot me dead in front of my kids.
You got to watch out for these disabled youngsters, you know. They might attack
you.
Yeah,
in case I made a wrong move, made me stand out in the rain for an hour. Took our prescriptions and copied them. They had rubber gloves on. They admitted, they said, we came out here to take your kids and take you into custody. In the end, they couldn't take my kids. They couldn't take me, and they couldn't even take our pot.
Did they apologize?
Not really, no. Not really.
Did you consider a lawsuit against them?
Yeah, but you know, I mean, I have to pick my battles.
Of course you do.
And things like that, especially when Stanford gets involved, that's a lifelong commitment.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And Santa Clara County, I mean, the brutal response to homelessness there. Really brutal. We don't want your daughter here because she costs too much money. And you don't really live here in Santa Clara County. Goodbye.
Now, was this a similar police midnight thing, or?
That was what happened. That was what I just described.
Oh, you're talking about Palo Alto and Santa Clara County.
Palo Alto, yeah.
It is? I thought it was in yeah, okay, that is Santa Clara County, right?
Yeah, it is Santa Clara County. I mean, it was just brutal.
Huh. And what other counties have kind of given you a mixed reception? Or?
Actually, the only places we've really been hassled parking on the streets were San Francisco and Arcata.
Hmm. Arcata, the green town. That's the town the Green City Council majority, right?
Yeah,
Green Party.
You don't want to get me started on the Green.
Please, let me get started. Tell me a little bit about that, will you, please?
No, we just don't get along. I'm a smoker, and I tried to go to a Nader rally in Chico, and they ran me off.
Because?
Because I smoke cigarettes.
Was that your only beef with the Greens, or have there been any problems?
No. You know, I think that, like, up in Arcata, they're not who they claim to be.
In what respect? How about in terms of people who live in their vehicles? That's really my primary focus. And has the Greens City Council majority up there, I know they had a majority a few years ago, decriminalized sleeping in vehicles, or what's...
Oh, no. No, Arcata, the police will come by and tell you that they have a camping ban and tell you to go to the KOA.
And is there still a Green Party majority up there in the city
council?
I
think there is. They've also just recently made dogs illegal in something like a 30 square block area downtown. And
do they tend to selectively enforce laws at the town square against hippies and poor people like they used to? Or?
You know, I suppose I only lived up there for 3 months, about a year and a half ago.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't feeling real well. I didn't go out that much. It's the only place I've ever been stopped by the police driving around in our motorhome with all of our stoner stickers on the back.
And what kind of a stop was it?
I think I had a tail light out. They just wanted to see who I was, make sure I had insurance.
But they never ticketed you for sleeping at night?
No. The one time that they came by, they had a complaint from the auto paint shop next door about the marijuana fumes. They since shut down the paint shop because of the paint fumes. But
right.
And they came and they checked our prescriptions and looked at our marijuana and then told us we should go to the KOA. And I don't know. I think we went out to Vista Point where we'd never had any trouble.
It's not really fair to say that the Green City Council and the police operating under them is specifically going after people for camping, rather on a complaint basis.
They were on a daily basis, rousting people. I don't know how many people they were actually ticketing, but when you'd read the newspaper, they would list, you know, all the police actions, and on a daily basis, they were hassling different groups of campers around town. They'd just keep people moving and make sure they knew that it wasn't done.
But this isn't allowed. Some sort of sanctuary. No magnet effect here, man.
Right. Well, they'd run the kids, you know, at one point they'd run all the kids out of Santa Cruz and San Francisco, and all the kids ended up in Arcata, so then they turned around and tried to run all the kids out of Arcata.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really solve anything.
Well, it's a regional sport, you know.
Yeah, I know. I've noticed.
Well, so...
But I find Santa Cruz, you know, having come back after 5 years, that it seems a lot more tolerant than it was 5 years ago.
Really? Interesting. I mean, I've heard people say the opposite. I've heard people... Either you get extreme views on one side or the other. I haven't heard anybody say this same as ever, but, you know,
yeah.
it's interesting. I mean, certainly you're being given... what sounds to be like, I mean, model treatment of a kind, you know, except I guess you may be encountering CPS problems or something. But.
Not really. Actually, what I did after the experience at Stanford, I was so angry, I came over here and we forced CPS to investigate us the minute we arrived,
mm-hmm.
which was not easy because they don't, I mean, this was ridiculous. I'm talking to this woman on the phone, and she says, well, it just sounds like you're a good, caring parent. And I said, lady, you don't get it. We're at New Brighton Beach. I'm going back to the campsite. I'm going to roll the biggest joint you've ever seen, and I'm going to smoke it with my 9-year-old. And she said, well, it sounds like you really care. And I said, no, okay, look, somebody's going to call you, and they're not going to get hold of you. They're going to get hold of some member of the Christian right, you know, and you people are going to do something horrible again. I just don't want it to happen. So I finally got them to investigate me. And actually, on Tuesday, this meeting I'm having with the regional center, a CPS agent will be there in support of my daughter and I.
Wow, that's a real change.
Right, marijuana. Well, it takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of anger. I had to be. I mean, we went down and forced them to investigate us. We went down with some signs with swastikas on them, calling them Nazis. My daughter and I picketed them for a while.
Good for you.
You know, I mean, you have to be. Sometimes I don't like the person I have to be to take care of my daughter.
Well, you certainly would offend the local Green Party with those kinds of tactics. I got to tell you. But that's another story. I'm actually going to be talking about how the Green Party is dealing with the homeless issue later on. There was their monthly Green Assembly was yesterday at the Loudoun Nelson Center, and I'm afraid it was not good for homeless people, at least from my perspective.
No, weren't they gearing up to do something to you personally?
Oh yeah, that certainly wasn't pleasant for me either.
What did they do to you, Robert?
Well. I'm still in one piece, and I have all my vital organs attached. However, what happened was I brought a resolution to the Green Party Assembly. I've been a member. I got to be very careful about this because they want you to date your membership just from when the registration is actually formally filed in the offices. I actually became a member by signing their forms in mid-February or so, or late February. But the form didn't reach the office until March, I think it was 15th. That's for all you Green Party people listening. I don't see why of a party that's open, concerned.
And I think that was a technical hang-up, folks. We're going to perhaps get a call back from Scott Simons. But I'll continue with my discussion of the Green Party. Yeah, actually, I probably should talk about this either when Scott calls back or at a bit later in the show. I'm going to talk about it. I really want to focus on the issues that all of us, Green Party, Democratic Party, human beings on the streets, everybody, needs to address in terms of, well, letting the kinds of conditions that Scott is enjoying become more widespread and making sure that the $54 fine for sleeping is removed now and forever from this town and hopefully from every town in this country. That's part of the Green Party platform, by the way, but of course you wouldn't know that from Green Party activity, which is focusing not on Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, who is keeping that ban in place and off the agenda, but on activists like myself who are trying to change it.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
We got cut off.
No problem. Well, I was just explaining, I don't know if you heard the radio, did you have a radio near you and I just went through that last rap? Or?
No, but that's okay.
Okay, well, you asked about the Green Party, and what happens is every month the Green Party has an assembly from 4 to 6 in the Loudoun Nelson Center. There was a relatively light turnout this time. Sometimes there was as many as 40 people. This time there were about 20, 25 maybe at the most. And I had been... trying to get the homeless working group. Well, the homeless working group had been given a resolution by Becky Johnson, another activist with HUF, itemizing Green Party Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice's record on the sleeping ban, which was essentially to support the sleeping ban and to refuse to change it in any really substantive way that would make meaningful, that would abolish it or make it contingent upon other behavior, or in other words, it's still a crime to sleep thanks to Tim Fitzmaurice. And
that's what I've been reading.
Yeah, I mean, particularly after the November election, when he gained the majority on the council and became the mayor, he's had the opportunity to change it, to suspend it, to make exceptions to it, and in fact, no such changes have been made, at least as a matter of law. Now, maybe there's some subterranean process happening, although it sounds like you don't violate the sleeping ban. You can park two vehicles in a business parking lot, but that's usually with the written permission of the owner.
Oh, we were on the streets, though.
You were on the streets?
Yeah,
Violating the sleeping ban. I'm going to have to come and ticket you, I'm afraid.
And we were at Harvey West last night on the street, and the last 2 weeks we've been at Greyhound Rock. But listen, I'm going to have to listen to you on the radio.
Yeah, it sounds like you got stuff you got to do.
Sativa just woke up.
I will let you get back to her.
And I've already got you turned on. Listen, thanks for talking.
Hey,
it's a pleasure talking to
thanks
you.
Thanks for telling us what's going on.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And for those who want to make $12.50 an hour as a nanny, or just perhaps talk to Scott Simons, although it sounds like he's kind of busy, so give him a little room here. His number is 278-9020, not 278-9020, and he's parked, as I understand it, on the street, Pacific Avenue, on Cathcart and Pacific, I believe that's what he said. For Scott's benefit, again, I guess to give the update on the Green Party scene. Wow, do I want to get into this now? Well, briefly, in February, the Green Party was presented with a resolution that said, your Green Party platform states, and I really should be reading you the platform, and I believe we have it here. The platform says, today, homeless people are hounded, threatened, and often cannot obtain badly needed services. Though affordable housing could help alleviate the problem of homelessness, the homeless have needs that go beyond housing. The Green Party calls for measures to help the homeless, expand community-based services for the homeless, and make them more readily available. Repeal all laws that criminalize any facet of homelessness or helping the homeless. Abolish anti-sleeping laws, especially in areas which don't have adequate open space, shelter, and sleeping areas for the homeless. This is part of the Green Party platform. You can find it on the web. So I'm not making it up. And it's actually true that if you talk to most Green Party members and tell them about the sleeping ban, they'll say, what a stupid law. Let's change that law. But of course, the other side of this coin, unfortunately, is Green Party members tend to have an unusual affection, adoration, or credulity towards Green Party politicians. And Tim Fitzmaurice, and to some extent Ed Porter, though he's a registered Democrat, he was endorsed by the Greens, Green Party politicians are able to get away with lots, particularly if they agree to talk to you and reassure you, rather than do something real, like make an effective legal change, make a public statement, act on campaign promises that were made in Fitzmaurice's case 2 years ago, in Porter's case last year during the election campaign of 2000. So the Green Party response, the resolution by Becky Johnson in February said, look, Fitzmaurice has spent the whole winter not only ignoring the homeless, not expanding shelter by one iota, 80% of homeless people are outside without shelter and they face criminalization. And I have my experience with sleeping tickets is not that there's a problem necessarily in those cases where they're issued, and moreover the people are harassed and told to move on, even who are not and not given tickets, but who are not specifically creating any problem. And admittedly it's hard to tell. I'm not there and I'm getting the side of the person getting the ticket, and it's hard to get the police officers to respond one way or the other. You know, they feel they're violating the privacy rights of the person and so forth, and that's a problem. So it is it's a judgment call, and you have to use your own eyes and ears to make these, and your own brain to determine, you know, what's really going on here. And I'm not saying that there's any final answer. I'm always happy to hear about this kind of positive stuff that we just heard from Scott. But I think human rights can't be a matter of discretion. They have to be a matter of right. And the Green Party states that too. Unfortunately, the Green Party mayor has done something quite different. Three of us, actually was 17 of us, one after another, did the City Council coffee clutch, which was a sort of a lobbying effort at City Council offices throughout December, where during the business hours, actually during 10 to 12 and 1 to 3 more or less, we'd show up at 10 to 12 outside the City Council offices with coffee for homeless folks who were cold and also who wanted to present their concerns to the mayor and the City Council members. Not at any meeting, because they were refusing to hold meetings, and they had recessed for the winter throughout much of that time without putting the sleeping ban on the agenda or offices. Two or three of us, or one or two of us usually, sometimes one of us, reading a book with a sign and with some flyers. And we would leave messages for council members asking to meet with council members, asking they consider putting the stuff on the agenda, asking if they would come and meet with other people. And it was, it was a lobbying effort. It's what people do in Sacramento. It's a particular form of lobbying. The response of Mayor Fitzmaurice became more and more hostile. We would also talk to people who would come in and visit, and they would actually... we'd see people coming to the offices, we'd talk to them in a friendly fashion and explain what we were doing there and how the City Council members were refusing to take any action and could perhaps they appeal to them. And no person ever complained of our behavior in any criminal way to the police. In fact, no employee ever made such a complaint that I'm aware of. Instead, Fitzmaurice began denouncing us for harassing his administrative aide, Anna Brooks, who is one of the two aides who sits in that outer office area, which is public and open to the public from 8 to 12 and from 1 to 5. And she never complained to me, specifically herself. I never heard her union rep complain to me. I never heard her boss, Martine Bernal, or Suzanne Haber, I'm not sure who's immediately in charge above her, but I believe it's one of those two people, complain. There was never a complaint from Tim Fitzmaurice of a specific problem that his staff was having. He would just come out and say to us in a harsh, censorial tone, "You're harassing my staff. I want you all to leave." We would look at him and say, "Have you read your constitution lately? What are you talking about?" And he would then stalk off. And we couldn't get any kind of meaningful statement. In fact, what he was doing was he was preparing a court case. At least that's the estimation of myself, Becky Johnson, and Bernard Klitzner, the three people against whom this court action was finally directed. This was not a criminal action. This was a civil action. And he was not the named plaintiff. He wasn't the person who supposedly... was on the action, whose name was on the action, not supposedly, was on the action. Anna Brooks applied for an injunction against us. She claimed that we were harassing her, and she gave a 10 to 12 page declaration which cited such things as pilfering pens, interrupting her conversations, speaking in loud voices, videotaping her, tape recording what was going on in the office, numerous small instances, perhaps they were large to her, but nothing that she ever felt was newsworthy, noteworthy, or harmful enough to call the police about. And the police actually did get called at one point on an ambiguous issue. We weren't sure what it was. And Sergeant Baker was taking photos and so forth, and I said, "Sergeant Baker, since you're here, I would like to record a complaint about Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice." Earlier today, or perhaps it was yesterday, Tim Fitzmaurice came up and told several members of this group they had to leave the public office. And he did so in an intimidating fashion, with the force of his office behind him, his public office, that is, his mayorship. That's a pretty nasty thing to say to members of the public, and I would like you to direct him that he is not to tell people to leave a public space, at least not in that tone of voice, not with the implied authority behind it that indicates that we somehow don't have the right to be there. And Baker, of course, just sort of, shined us on, although both of us recorded this, and this will hopefully be coming up at our evidentiary hearing on May 29th. But this report, there was a police report made, and when I tried to get it from Sergeant Baker, he told me it was confidential and an inter-office affair. We're now trying to subpoena it, and that may be a better way to go. We may be able to get it. But as happens behind the scenes in the Green Party, as happens in SCAN, as happens in closed sessions of the City Council, there is a... a kind of a it's David versus Goliath on this stuff. You don't get the information, you don't get a fair level playing field. You get people engaging in the abuse of power covered up with a happy face. And the happy face here, of course, was that they were trying to help poor Anna Brooks, who was being driven crazy by activists doing all kinds of bizarre and vicious, but apparently not violent things, because that was not alleged. In every previous order, and this is an interesting thing, in every previous order that the city paid for, and Anna Brooks's fees were paid for by the city, and the city attorney filed, and Anna Brooks did get the city attorney, John Barisoni, to file this, the action involved either violence or threats of violence or a past history of violence. In other words, it had to do with real harassment, for which the statute was actually originally intended. And what happens in a harassment statute is usually the victim goes to court, in this case the plaintiff, and says, hey, I'm being harassed, and the court immediately issues an order without a hearing. That's what happened in this case, but that was a violation of the law, because in our case there were First Amendment issues that had to do with the fact that we were in a public office, and we weren't at all addressing her. We were waiting for her boss, the mayor, and his colleagues, the city council members, to take action on an issue of public interest and importance, the sleeping ban and the fate of homeless people in this community. So I've kind of wound around a lot, and it's all relevant. I mean, we've recently had a hearing. We had a hearing last week on this. We've gone through three or four hearings. We're barred from being within 50 yards, three of us, of the city hall, except when there are public meetings and except when we're there on official business, and then only outside of this one building, which houses the offices of all the city council members and the mayor. We cannot go into that office, or we'll be arrested on possible felony charges. So there's a serious violation of basic First Amendment rights happening here, the right to petition and assemble, not the right to protest. I mean, I believe in the right to protest too, but this wasn't the right to protest. We weren't protesting in a sense of, either doing an action that was illegal or even engaging in legal, chanting sort of activity. That wasn't what we were doing. We were lobbying. It's true, we were visibly lobbying, and we were continuously lobbying, fairly continuously, but we were in no way engaging in either protest, really, or in any kind of civil disobedience, which means, say, staying in an office afterward or doing a sit-in. The Metro inaccurately described this as a sit-in. I think it's more accurately described, using Becky Johnson's words, as a wait-in. For example, back in May of 2000, we did a similar week-and-a-half-long wait-in. We called it Waiting for Sugar, and that, of course, had to do with Mayor Sugar, Councilmember Sugar now, but Mayor Sugar then, who had the keys in his hand to put the sleeping ban on the agenda and finally did. And it wasn't just us who did it, but I think we helped. It was also the fasts of a lot of activists petitioning for an initiative, a Pie in the Pusser Award, and street organizing. A lot of stuff was happening there, and I'm going to actually do a little playing of some of that later, I hope, although it looks like we may be running out of time. But so the Green Party throughout this whole thing was presented in February with a petition from Becky Johnson, who's a Green Party member, been a member for years, saying, look, what's going on? Your platform says no sleeping bans. Your mayor is continuing to keep the sleeping ban in place. He has a majority to change it, and he won't do it. And when people ask him, he says he hasn't got the support, and his constituency doesn't support changing it, and so forth. So obviously the Green Party isn't his constituency. It's not clear what part of his constituency he's talking about. He certainly does have the votes. Himself, Crone, Sugar, and Porter, definitely, and then probably Riley and Kennedy as well. It's probably 6-1, is my guess, if he had the courage, or any of those people had the courage to put it on the city council agenda. It would be nice if we had the power, we the people had the power to put it on the agenda, as, for example, they do in Santa Barbara, and I believe in Berkeley, where the sleeping ban is coming up on Tuesday in the form of a human rights resolution, though I may be wrong there. Maybe they have a council member in Berkeley. Perhaps Model Sharik is putting it on the agenda up there. Anyway, the Green Party was presented with this concern. So what they did was they took this concern and they sent it to the Homeless Working Group, a new group chaired by a man who has been an activist in the past, a playwright, concerned with police abuse and other concerns, but more recently Green Party politician sort of person. Politician isn't quite the word, activist perhaps. He doesn't have any political office. He's been a friend of mine in the past. I'm sure he'll be a friend of mine again. Perhaps he's a friend of mine now. It doesn't feel that way. he headed this little group of the homeless working hopeless working group of the Green Party. And initially, we did get a few things done. I introduced a resolution having to do with guarantees for the Dolphin and Lee tenants. These are the folks in the beach flats that are going to be essentially evicted, and some of them readmitted to housing that Mercy Charities Housing builds and eventually owns with city money. But it'll be less housing than was there to begin with in terms of the number of people served. And that's been a concern of a lot of us, and also very expensive housing, and certainly not the kind of cost-effective housing that a lot of us had hoped for, where we suggested buying property, building on vacant land, and so forth. We talked about this. And this is an ongoing problem. So, but the Green Party, to its credit, just as Scan, to its credit, simply passed a resolution saying, hold it, give the people guarantees before you kick them out. Well, Nick Whitehead, when he kind of brought the kind of announcement that this was, though it hadn't passed the Green Party Assembly, but had kind of been bruited about and had been passed by the homeless working group and was headed for the Green Assembly to the City Council and mentioned that, he got shafted big time by a new group called the Steering Working Group of the Green Party. They denounced him seven ways from Sunday for bringing up this issue. Now, I actually don't know how vigorously they denounced him, but that seemed to be my impression on talking with him. Different people had different interpretations. So some of the people in our homeless working group said, hey, you know, we don't think that's really terribly appropriate to denounce our good Green Party worker, Nick Whitehead, and we brought that up. This apparently was one of the catalysts that created some problems. And another one was the fact that Lydia Blanchard, who is an activist for a number of years, has been working through a number of groups in her way, in her direction, trying to get the city council to change or end the sleeping ban. Unfortunately, Lydia, from my perspective, has rather rigid guidelines about how one should work on these issues. And if you don't follow her guidelines, you really shouldn't be working in the same group she is. And so if you happen to be working in the same group she is, like I was, then you know, you either follow the rules or get out. The rules in this case are you don't scorn members of the city council. You aren't harsh toward them and criticize them in strong public ways. That if they don't want you to be present in that group, you leave the group. That if they don't want you, for example, planning the town meeting that the Monday morning group, which is a group fighting the sleeping ban, is planning under the leadership of Michael Schmidt, Dan Alper, Lydia Blanchard, and others to hold in July, then you should just leave the whole thing in order to let it go forward. And my perspective on this has always been, certainly I want to facilitate that process, but I do not think it's wise to allow city council members who have shown hostility and indifference to changing the law, to taking any real public action, to have a real sort of say in controlling the people who are lobbying them. In other words, what you first have to do is get a lot of public support around the issue, and then the council will come to you. And the only real basis for letting the council set any kind of conditions at all is if they're reasonable conditions. And insisting that certain people not be involved was used last year by Mayor Sugar, for example, when David Silva was negotiating, to really split up the activists and eventually to destroy the whole movement around the sleeping ban, to reform it. You remember that was the safe zones in May and June of last year that passed a first reading but weren't even brought up for a second reading until 1 o'clock at night on June 27th, actually June 28th, but the session started on the 27th, and then they were simply dumped. And then the next meeting and the meeting thereafter, the whole city council members betrayed promises to Silva to put the issue on the ballot. So the whole thing was a complete sellout at the end, and I think that was because United Front was not maintained, because some of the activists in the center, including David Silva, and here now, as we see happening more recently, Lydia is doing this, are agreeing to engage in exclusionary meetings with city council members. And I just feel this is wrong, and this is a failed strategy, and this has been my perspective. Now, you can always turn around and say, hey, they just don't like you. Why don't you step aside? Well, they didn't like me. They didn't like Becky Johnson. I don't think James Nay would have been admitted to these things. Last year, Bernard Klitzner was eventually not asked back. I mean, it spreads, and it's a very insidious and vicious sort of process, and also it's just unwise for activists to allow this to happen, and it's the wrong target. You don't go after the city council as a schmoozing kind of, you don't try to adopt the city council as your, you know, as your dad or as your child. You don't try to have a close relationship with the city council on this issue, because the only way to have a close relationship with them is to accept their position, which fundamentally is we're not going to change the law, but we'd like to make people think we are and think we're doing something else, like maybe build a family shelter in a year or two. See, that seems to be the constant refrain that they use, or the constant strategy they have. And those of us who've been working on it for years have seen it quite clearly done again and again. And city council members like to cut those of us off from this whole strategy. I mean, they want to cut us out of the picture because we blow the whistle. We say, hey, it's not that we disrupt meetings, although that actually might be a fine idea if the meetings aren't going anywhere and it's a sham, but I'm actually kind of timid about that. I mean, I am pretty, you know, I'll make strong speeches. I'll insist that people have the right to be heard. I'll do protests and demonstrations, and I will stand up and speak when Sugar or Fitzmaurice close oral communications before it should be closed, or impose unfair restrictions on the media, definitely, or attempt to cut off public comment when there is should be a public comment period after each agenda item. I do that, and maybe some people regard that as disruptive. But getting back to the Green Party meeting and what happened yesterday, boy, I've taken a long time to do it. The Green Party meeting yesterday was a two-hour meeting, the last 45 minutes of which, instead of studying how to make sure that Fitzmaurice is held accountable, or even that there's just the city council is reminded that the armory is closing, people are out on the streets, rents are high, and we need our Green Party members to be aware of this, presented officially as a Green Party position by a person walking up to the mic, our Green Party in this town could not see its way clear to that resolution. And you might ask yourself, why couldn't they just, that's a very simple thing. We weren't asking for mass protests, so I think that would be excellent. We weren't asking for a lockdown at city council or, people to immolate themselves in the hallways. Nothing like that. It looks like it's going to take mass protest of a peaceful sort to get this done, to get the council off its, dead center again. All we asked was a Green Party spokesperson to come up and say, hey, Green Party platform says this, not even mentioning Fitzmaurice by name, just we urge Green Party office holders to take action on this issue because the armory is closing. It was a longer, more elaborate resolution, but that was the gist of it. And instead of talking about that, they chose to talk for 45 minutes, half an hour to 45 minutes, about me. And this is what happened, sort of was a repetition of what had happened in two previous Green Party groups. And the reason they wanted to talk about me was because Lydia Blanchard and several other members felt that unless we could be nice to Tim Fitzmaurice, unless he was wooed and other council members were wooed, we wouldn't get anywhere. And therefore, I had to be essentially either kind of muzzled, strapped in, or excluded from the situation. Lydia's already succeeded in doing this from the Monday morning group, which, by the way, nobody else is excluded from. So if you want to find out what's going on the Monday morning group and maybe get the other side, they may tell you a different story. You can go to the Baker's Square every Monday morning at 8 o'clock. And to their credit, they're also trying to move that meeting out to the Homeless Services Center so actual, real, honest-to-God homeless people could get involved, and I commend that, certainly. Again, that's tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in the morning. Get up early and, take your coffee money with you. If you haven't got coffee money, I'd suggest just pull up a chair at the table of the Monday morning group. But the Monday morning group had me excluded because they said Chris Crone won't meet with us if you're in this group. And it looks like Ed Porter won't either. And we're just going to have to, it's more important to have them meeting with us than have you in the group. And, that has some, superficial plausibility. I mean, some people, you should sacrifice yourself for the good of the group. If they're going to meet with you, the group without you and do the same good things, why not? Well, because they're not going to do the same good things. Because by letting the city council set the group's agenda and its membership, you fundamentally change the whole equation. And that's the whole point. I warned this group about it like 2 months ago when it was being formed, when somebody asked me to give them a hand helping them form it, getting people involved in it. I said, sure. But beware of this. They will attempt to separate us, to exclude so-called militants and radicals. And not because of any behavioral problems. I mean, if somebody caught, starts screaming at people in the middle of the meeting, slapping them around, I mean, you know, or violating the process of the meeting, that is a basis for excluding someone, certainly, whoever they are, whatever their political views. But that has not been the case with in my situation in the Green Party or in other groups. It just hasn't. There's no history of that. And that's why it is so outrageous what's going on. So I talked about the Monday morning group. The same thing is happening in the Green Party. The homeless working group, after having passed this good Dolphin and Lee resolution, turned to issues like how can we hold Tim Fitzmaurice accountable? And what should we do about that? And they decided they were going to write him a letter and invite him to come to the group. And I said, sure, just you know, write him a letter. I mean, what's the big deal? Well, they still haven't finished their letter, as far as I know. I've heard no evidence they've sent the letter off to Fitzmaurice. This was proposed 2 months ago. They, at the last meeting they had 3 weeks ago, instead of taking up a proposal I had, which is just send Tim a chronology of the allegations, not, you know, a history of his behavior on the sleeping ban, and ask him to, is this correct? Is this complete? If it isn't, strike it out. Change it. Tell me what, you know, what's wrong with it. Correct our misimpression. And it doesn't have to be the homeless working group's misimpression. It's just a record, you know, that was presented, in this case by Becky Johnson. It was part of her original concern. And it's certainly, she's a Green Party member. She has a right to put that forward. Well, instead of talking about this, the homeless working group brought up an item called behavior in meetings, which supposedly had to do with my behavior in meetings. But they didn't talk about my behavior in meetings. They talk about the fact that on the radio I discuss these issues and I'm critical of the Green Party and I'm critical of the homeless working group, but I'm still a member of the homeless working group, and there's somehow some strange contradiction there that I'm a journalist and that I said I was a Green Party member when I wasn't a Green Party member, and I explained that a moment ago, that my belief that you when you register as a Green Party member is when you sign the form, but it was pointed out to me you have to have it turned in, has to be by the voter registrar, and that's true. But in the Green, it has to be understood, in all these Green Party events, everything is open to the public anyway, and I took no action that would have blocked anything. So it's a strange thing that they were expressing his concerns. Now here's a phone call. Let's see if we can include the public.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Robert.
Hi.
It's not like you're calling yourself a progressive or anything.
I'm progressively worse, man.
Yeah.
So how are you doing there?
I'm feeling pretty bad. I just got over a throat thing.
Oh, well, don't give it to me. Keep your mouth away from the phone.
Yeah, no kidding. But it's you're talking about the whole article in the
Metro.
Rag.
It was mentioned in the Metro. Yeah, I mean, David Silva claims he wasn't properly quoted, but he's still saying to me, "I won't talk to you until after the sleeping ban has ended," which probably means sometime at the end.
That's why they call it the news.
Yeah, the blues,
the news.
Right, news and blues, or bluesy news.
Yeah, at least you're not calling yourself progressive, like some other people that will go unmentioned.
Damn right, man. Well, I don't know what I am, but I'm cranky. That's for sure. No
you're making waves, man.
Yes, sir.
You're making waves.
Anything else you want to say before I continue with my?
You're making waves, and they're pitiful.
Well, thank you.
Well, that certainly didn't sound like a Green Party member. So anyway. This is all background. Yesterday at the Green Party meeting, the only thing that happened was, for half an hour to 45 minutes, I was simply criticized by a number of people and essentially not given a real opportunity to respond. I mean, I did have a couple of moments to speak back on the issue, but I wasn't prepared for it in the sense that I was assured by the homeless working group, by the steering working group, which controls the agenda for the Green Party Assembly, and by the Green Party Assembly facilitator, that this would be all. The only resolution that would be considered would be that they would appoint monitors to come and watch the Green Party meeting to see what problems there were, with no names attached. Well, immediately a Green Party member named Joe Rigby stood up and said, "This is not enough. The person who we're concerned about is really this vicious Robert Norris character who violates this and that," and he launched into a long denunciation of me. I pointed out to the chair that this is a violation of the process. All that's being discussed is a resolution to simply send some monitors, and that's what's being discussed. Said, no, what we need to do is impose instead other kinds of sanctions and bar this person from the homeless working group for a year and that sort of thing. And I said, this isn't on the agenda, Joe, but I couldn't get the chair to make that ruling. So for 45 minutes, I got trashed by person after person who wanted to trash me, and other people who No one stood up and said, here's an activist who's been working on this issue for 10 years. Here's somebody through whose activity we have a free meal. I'm not the only one responsible for it. We have modifications in the sleeping ban. We have the right to sell a street newspaper on the streets. We have expanded homeless shelter. We have city council rules which allow attending subcommittees. We have rules which allow attending the Brown Act applies to committees like the Police Review Board Subcommittee, which isn't meeting because Mayor Sugar and now Mayor Fitzmaurice apparently don't want it to meet in an open way. But if they do meet, it has to be open. The subcommittees of the city council are open because myself and Nick Whitehead, ironically enough, 10 years ago walked into, this was, civil disobedience, although maybe it was just enforcing the real law, walked into the meeting of this Kennedy closed subcommittee and said, you're not closing this anymore, Scott. This is an open committee from now on. That's the Brown Act. And rather than arrest us, they changed their rules, or at least they changed their policy and admitted that. I've been working around this issue for a decade, and I shouldn't have to toot my own horn. And there were plenty of people in that room who knew me, but they were all spending their time saying, well, you know, Robert's probably done a lot of bad things, but let's wait till we get the report. And I suppose in a way that was politically strategic. But for people who didn't know me very well in that Green Party meeting, they walked away with a much lower opinion of the person I was and of the work I'd done, because long-term activists who'd worked with me had nothing to say about the kinds of things I'd done that really were the background for all this. The background for all this is that the Green Party wants to cover Tim Fitzmaurice's ass, or they want to be real, real sure that they have everything in place before they take a teeny-tiny baby step. And this does not serve the interests of homeless people, civil rights in general, or the community. It just doesn't. It serves the interests of Tim Fitzmaurice and those who believe it's more important to have a Green Party politician up there than it is to have civil rights for everybody in place. And I suppose the counterargument is, well, you're only going to change civil rights if you can appeal to the politicians. So if civil rights in the South would have changed by appealing to the politicians? You know, I don't think so. You have to speak the truth on these issues and get wide segments of the community mobilized. And unfortunately, what's going on here is the opposite of that. And it's all pretty sad. After they spent all this time trashing me, the guy who introduced this resolution, Joe Rigby, right before I was going to speak, withdrew the resolution and said, oh, okay, I withdraw it. After they've done all this trashing, and instead we're going to do is simply go back to this monitoring him, send a couple of monitors to this group, not send monitors to Tim Fitzmaurice and the city council to see if the sleeping ban is being enforced and if this continued violation of Green Party policy is happening. Oh no, that's not going to be monitored. We don't want to monitor that. We want to first write a nice letter to Tim and have him sort of come to the group, right? I haven't gone into this openly a lot because I kind of hoped to avoid embarrassing the Green Party in this way. I mean, I've been a little harsh with folks around the issue, but I've tried to be not name names like I'm naming them today and be more circumspect. But frankly, I don't feel good being trashed with lies, I might add, falsehoods, with vague accusations. And more important, I am outraged by the fact that the Green Party is members, at least most of them, at this meeting, well, all of them were unwilling to stop this process. I mean, they were just as the homeless working group spent 90 minutes trashing me 3 weeks ago instead of doing homeless issues, so this group chose to do half an hour of trashing, and then they claimed they didn't have time to talk about the real resolution, which was that the Green Party take just a small stand, go to the city council and say, the Green Party platform says this. Can office holders who are, or those who've been endorsed by the Green Party, please, you know, remember the Green Party platform, particularly considering the shelter emergency, considering the rent emergency, considering the death toll, that sort of thing. So none of that happened. This resolution was blocked by three people. I mean, what did happen was they did appoint monitors to come and observe homeless working group meetings, which haven't been held, by the way, because they're afraid of my coming and sitting there. It's not like I'm disrupting them or interrupting them. They don't have any basis for any of what they're saying is the problem. So they say, oh, you write nasty things about us, and you introduce too many resolutions. Well, they control how many resolutions get on the agenda. So if they don't want to put my resolutions on the agenda, they don't have to. It's a matter of a 25-second vote. I mean, it's all pretty bogus. And it seems to me that stirring all this stuff up is a way of avoiding the issue that they really don't like, which is making sure that Tim Fitzmaurice either dumps the Green Party label or the Green Party dumps Tim Fitzmaurice. I mean, if the Green Party only exists because they got Tim Fitzmaurice in office and he's their jewel, things are in pretty bad shape for the Green Party, I got to tell you. Locally, it's pretty horrible. I guess I'm not one to say what the trade-off should be. Maybe, you know, they get Fitzmaurice puts on the agenda the Fair Trade of the Americas, Association of the Americas resolution, and therefore they should be quiet about his policy on the sleeping ban. Therefore, they should go real slow on that. I see that as fundamentally corrupt policy, and I think it destroys the credibility of the Green Party. I really do. And I think that attacking me is a complete diversion. And I spend a number of minutes on it because people have asked me about it. And I'm going to try to turn out a flyer about it to talk about the specific allegations that are made and the truth of the situation. I tried to talk to Joe Rigby, the guy who just insisted on taking up the entire meeting with this specific personal attack against me that was not stopped by the chair and by other Green Party members, even though some people objected, but they didn't take make the necessary consistent objections that they had to make. And it's kind of hard. I would have had to say every time they asked for an extension of time, no, I block this, I veto this. You cannot talk about me anymore. You have to talk about the resolution on the floor. I should have done it, but the trouble is it sounds so self-serving. It puts me in a position where I look like I'm simply covering my own ass. So I was screwed no matter what I did. It felt really bad. And it also was bad for the Green Party and bad for the community, because Fitzmaurice needs to have the Green Party telling him, end the sleeping ban, you haven't done it, why haven't you done it? And it's not happening. But people should know, if you join the Green Party, you're involved in a party that is not telling Tim Fitzmaurice to end the sleeping ban, that is not voting resolutions, that is instead attacking activists like myself and to some extent Becky Johnson, who was at the meeting, who are trying to do so. So that is sort of what happened in a half an hour rant. Let's see what we have to break up this situation. I would say this might be a good idea as a prelogue to Jim Costner, who will be coming on in a moment. A little bit of his Thursday speech at the Veterans Hall.
Bunch of park protesters sitting in the grass, wouldn't get up to let the bulldoze pass. Tearing down fences, making a mess, they're gonna get it and they couldn't care less. See you in Santa Rita, see you in Santa Rita, see you in Santa Rita, we are going to jail. Well, how many cops does it take to build a volleyball court against our will? Well, we're not sure because the number grows. Maybe the university knows. See you in Santa Rita, see you in Santa Rita, see you in Santa Rita, we are going to jail. Well, I like sports, I love a good game, but grass and concrete ain't the same. If they won't let us vote for the park to stay, I guess all that we can say is, see you in Santa Rita, see you in Santa Rita, see you in Santa Rita, we are going to jail. Well, what do you do when the PRC gets the shit beat out of them and still can't see, and city officials just sit on their hands? Jen gets ready to dump more sand. See you in Santa Rita, see you in Santa Rita, see you in Santa Rita, we are going to jail. One last time. See you in Santa Rita, see you in Santa Rita, see you in Santa Rita, we are going to jail, yeah, we are going to jail.
And that was Carol Denny, see you in Santa Rita, which of course is a jail up in Contra Costa County. I hope I don't see you in Santa Rita, and I hope I don't see Jim Costner in Santa Rita, but here's a little of Jim Costner in Santa Cruz. And I mean a little. Jim is hard to take in large doses, with all due respect.
I'm not supposed to even be talking to you or organizing. I'm supposed to sit in a little 6x7 until my trial where they can railroad me for taking out a genocidal maniac statue that represents nothing but a Hitler, nothing but a murderer and a rapist of all of you. And I don't want anybody in this room to be raped or murdered or enslaved or oppressed or exploited or disrespected or treated inferior. I'm tired of second-class citizenry. I'm tired of 10th-class citizenry. I'm tired of every human being on the earth being threatened with nuclear annihilation. I'm tired of the human beings not being free, because that is our right, that is our destiny, that is our fate, that is what is intended by creation, that is what we're going to get one day in this lifetime. I wanted to read a few quotes. This first one is from Russell Means, who was the founder of the American Indian Movement, and he says, this is in a book, War Churchill, and this is one of the introductions. It says, all my life I've had to listen to the rhetoric about the United States being a model of freedom and democracy, the most uniquely enlightened and humanitarian country in the history, a nation of laws, which unlike others has never pursued policies of conquest and aggression. I'm sure you've heard it before. It's official truth, in quotes, in the United States. It's what is taught to school children, and it's the line peddled to the general public. Well, I've got a hot news flash for everybody here. It's a lie. The whole thing's a lie, and it's always been. Leaving aside the obvious points which could be raised to disprove it by blacks and Chicanos and Asian immigrants right here in North America, not to mention the Mexicans, the Nicaraguans, the Guatemalans, the Puerto Ricans, the Hawaiians, the Filipinos, the Samoans, the Tamaros, of Guam, Marshall Islanders, the Koreans, the Vietnamese, the Cubans, the Dominicans, the Grenadians, the Libyans, the Panamanians, the Iraqis, and a few dozen other people out there who suffered American invasions, occupation firsthand. There's a little matter of genocide that's got to be taken into account right here at home. I'm talking about the genocide which has been perpetrated against Indians, a genocide that began the instant the first of Europeans, boat people, washed up on the beach of Turtle Island, a genocide that's continuing right now, at this moment, against Indians. There's not a law the United States hasn't broken, not a crime against humanity it hasn't committed, and it's still going on. Russell Means, American Indian Movement, October 12, 1992. This is just some of the reality, you know, that most of the world, most of America, as far as I can tell, is in denial of. But regardless of whether you're in denial of things or not, the truth is the truth. The fact that Mark Garcia got murdered with 7 cans of pepper spray, it don't matter if you're in denial. If you're in denial, the truth is the truth. The truth is the truth. Just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not true. This is an imperialist nation. You might not want to agree with that. You might not want to see it. But the fact is, this is an empire. This is an empire that rips off the people of the world every day to make certain people comfortable, while certain people get to experience a dream, while the vast majority of the world gets to experience the nightmare. Can I prove what I'm saying? Can the Iraqis prove what I'm saying? Can the Iraqi children prove what I'm saying? Can our indigenous relations on reservations prove what I'm saying? Can Mumia prove what I'm saying? Can Leonard Peltier prove what I'm saying? Can Move 9 prove what I'm saying? Can a bomb being dropped by the Philadelphia Police Department on Move House, one of the greatest revolutionary leaders of our time, John Africa, who was only talking about liberating life, and he gets bombed in a land of the free? Don't you see these hypocrisies and these contradictions? Aren't you tired of them? Do you want to see your relations get murdered like Danny? Do you want to see yourself be like John Donne and get shot in the street? You want this? You want Mumia to die in a cage? You want the capitalists to threaten us with nuclear annihilation? You want freedom? You want justice? Are you dead? Are you alive? Do you feel? Do you have passion? And I'm not trying to talk down to anybody, but I'm tired. I'm extremely tired of people being hurt in the world. This is a book called U.S. Imperialism, The Sworn Enemy of the Korean People. This is how disgusting that this government truly is. There's a picture on it, and it has a priest, and it has a Korean boy wrapped to a tree. And the priest, the so-called priest, because I acknowledge the difference between people who are real priests and who really serve God, and priests who are running around with the capitalists. This man right here, he's putting hydrochloric acid in the forehead of a Korean youth writing thief. Why is he doing that? because if you go into this book, it talks about how 1 year after the so-called Civil War came to an end in this country, in 1865, 1866, the United States government sent a boat of armed mercenaries to do what? To take over Korea, in their own words, to occupy it and to use it as a military base to invade the whole continent of Asia. And they say in their own words that this boy is a thief on his own land because he picked up an apple outside of his house. Now, what is an American doing in Korea, number one? What is America doing in Korea? And how can America call you being a thief when you're on your own land eating fruit that comes from the tree that's on your own land? How can you do that? They're talking about, in this book it goes into how America lost 500,000 U.S. soldiers in a so-called police action. What were they doing? Trying to defeat North Korea. This is the examples of this country. These are some of the examples of the history. You look at what indigenous people have experienced. You go into Ward Churchill's book. You go into Bartolomé de las Casas' book. You go into Dr. John Hendricks Clark's book. And they all tell you, Eduardo Galeano, he'll tell you, he tells you that Columbus was raping 11-year-olds and enjoying it. He tells you Columbus was raping 13-year-olds and enjoying it. He tells you that Columbus was slaughtering natives and feeding them to Spanish dogs. No exaggeration. How would you feel if somebody raped every single person in this room and killed about three quarters of you, and then they wanted to put a statue of that person outside your house? How would you feel? That is what it is. Columbus, in our house, on our land, is nothing but a tribute of like Hitler. We don't want nothing to do with Columbus. We don't want nothing to do with oppression. We don't want nothing to do with genocide. In fact, we want the end of it. We want the total abolition of all slavery and all oppression on this earth. Then people think that's not possible, or that can't be done, or the government is too strong or too powerful. The government is so powerful, how come Cuba hasn't been dislodged since 1959? If the government is so powerful, how come the Vietnamese drove this government out? If this government is so powerful, how come North Korea has never been defeated by it? If this government is so powerful, how come Brother Mumia Abu-Jamal, who they have locked down for 20 years, is alive when they tried to kill him three times? Three times they tried to kill him, and he's alive. But yet we're still experiencing oppression, genocide. The Kurds, 30 million people, don't have a homeland on the earth. Genocide, experiencing genocide. Arabs experiencing genocide, Indians experiencing genocide, Africans experiencing genocide, Rasa experiencing genocide. Can I prove this? What is the U.S. military doing today in Colombia? What is U.S. military doing today in Mexico, in Chiapas? What is U.S. military doing today in Panama? What is U.S. military doing in Haiti? What is U.S. military doing in Africa? What are they doing? They're putting down people's movements. That's what they're doing, don't lie about it. They're putting down leadership that is trying to organize and unite the different sections of the earth to free themselves from colonialism and capitalism and imperialism and white supremacy and all forms of domination. Steve Argue didn't even mention himself. That's a beautiful thing. Steve Argue, just a little while ago, spent 7 months in a cage right here in Santa Cruz County for doing a righteous act of defending a woman and a child during a peaceful protest when we were out there protesting the war in Yugoslavia, when they are annihilating Yugoslavians every day in this country, dropping bombs, murdering thousands upon tens of thousands. And where is the American saying? Where are the American people saying, what the fuck is up with that? Excuse the language, but what the fuck is up with that? Letting this government annihilate peaceful people in the world? Drop bombs on them? Why are we doing this? Why are we letting this happen? And why are we thinking, why are so many of us thinking that somehow we are more important than the fate of humanity? That somehow our individual lives and our material possessions are more important than whether children starve or not on the earth? Who got it into our head that makes it more important for our stereo systems in our houses than whether or not a genocide happens? Who put that in our head? Who put it in our head that makes men superior to women? How many women get raped every day in America? Do you know? Wait, what kind? This is civilization? If this is civilization, bring me back to barbarism, please. I'm teasing. I can't pass this off as civilization. I can't pass this off as a progress. I can't pass it off as anything that's good, moral. You know? As far as I'm concerned, that the whole world governments, excluding very few, are evil, wicked, twisted, running amok, and that threaten our whole human species, and getting away with it, and not being checked. What's going to check them? You. The people, that's the only thing that can check them. They don't get checked. They don't get stopped by not organizing. They get stopped by organizing. They get stopped by resistance. They get stopped by rebellion. They get stopped by revolution. They get stopped by people speaking out in fearless ways. They get stopped by people uniting. And I want to talk a little bit about this unity, because there's literally lots and lots of beautiful organizers in Santa Cruz. Lots. Effective organizers. But yet, we can't stay together very long without start talking bad about each other and start denouncing each other and start spending all this time criticizing each other. You know? We could have this whole room filled up if we wanted to. But how come it's not? 2,000 flyers gets us about 60 people? Is that the reality in America? 2,000 flyers gets you 60 people? 50 posters and a couple hundred bucks gets you 50 people in a room. You know? What happened to our humanity? And I'm not questioning the people in this room, because I'm very thankful that everybody in this room has come. I'm very thankful, because that's what it's going to take. I want to finish by a few things. And I want to say thank you to all the people who have come and give presentations tonight. And I want to say thank you to all the people who have come to be here tonight, because without you, there is no movement. Without you, there is no hope. With you, there's hope. With you, there's movement. I want to end with a few things. I want to say, basically, that for me, it's a question of good and evil. It's a question of oppression and slavery. It's a question of humanity and genocide. And we all have a choice. And we all have a role to play. And I would encourage every single human being in this room to play that role, to do everything that we possibly can.